There's a saying that everyone is Irish on St. Patrick's Day, but they weren't well received for the holiday in 1890.
After all of this happens, there is no St. Patrick's Day parade or no St. Patrick's Day picnic or no St. Patrick's Day anything, because the Irish reputation in Chicago is so tarnished by what had happened during the previous year.
With how lively the city is on March 17th, it may not come as a surprise that Chicago has the second highest Irish population in all of America and was one of the earliest cities in the nation to hold annual St. Patrick's Day festivities. But Chicago's history with the holiday is forever marked by a year where there was no celebration. So what's the city's history with the holiday? And what local event marred the reputation of the Irish for the whole nation? I'm your host, Jim Hankey, and in today's special holiday episode, we'll explore the origins of St. Patrick's Day celebrations in Chicago and how the Irish mob managed to set it all back. Hold on to your four-leaf clovers and let's get looped in, Chicago. Before Chicago even became a recognized city, Irish immigrants settled here as early as 1830. As more refugees came over to escape the Great Famine, Irish immigrants made up one-fifth of the city's population by 1850. And it didn't take long for these settlers to continue their cultural traditions, with the first St. Patrick's Day celebration in Chicago taking place in 1843. Podcast producer Ariel Ravenay spoke with Dr. Gillian O'Brien, a reader in modern Irish history at Liverpool John Moores University, about what those early celebrations would have looked like.
They do have parades, but they're not parades in the way that we would know them. They have what were referred to primarily as picnics. Again, the word picnic isn't really about you bringing your own little picnic and sitting down, but it's kind of a bigger day, like kind of a fair. So they do have those from the 1840s onwards, and they become much more formalized by the time you get to the 1870s, 1880s, where they are organized by particular societies and generally then as fundraisers. But yeah, there is an awareness and a presence of St. Patrick's Day in Chicago from very early on.
While St. Patrick's Day in America still holds some religious traditions today, it's often associated with grand parades, heavy drinking, and of course here, dyeing part of the Chicago River green. But the holiday's origin is important to the country of Ireland because it's a shared celebration between two sects of Christianity with a long history of religious discord.
The story of St. Patrick is that he brings Christianity to Ireland. That's not strictly true from a historical perspective, but you know, that doesn't matter. But he brings Christianity. He doesn't bring Catholicism or Protestantism. And given kind of the troubles in Ireland that often pitched two different Christian factions against each other, something unifying about having just a Christian saint, which was neither Catholic nor Protestant.
In those early decades of Chicago, St. Patrick's Day was an opportunity for Irish settlers to connect with their heritage, fundraise for their community, and publicly celebrate their culture. So what happened in the late 1880s to tarnish that tradition? Well, Dr. O'Brien studied as a fellow at the Newberry Library and wrote the first book to ever cover this event, titled Blood Runs Green: The Murder That Transfixed Gilded Age Chicago. Now, before we get into this tale, some important historical context. In the late 1800s, rebellions rose across Ireland as its people revolted against British rule. Safe from harm, those who settled in Chicago sought ways to help their countrymen back home.
What happens is, in the Chicago of the 1880s and later, you have a lot of the Irish settling around Bridgeport in the south. And it tends to be that as people in that area get wealthier, they tend to move north and up to kind of really around where the Gold Coast kind of is today. There isn't that much division in the 1880s because what you have in Chicago is this group called Clan na Gael, which means sort of the family of the Irish or the family of the Gael. And they're mostly united, though in every Irish sort of secret society, there's always division and people jostling for various attention. But their purpose is initially to fundraise in America and send that money back to Ireland, where there's a kind of fight for Irish freedom. But they're not supposed to be doing any of that fight. They're supposed to be the ones bringing the money for the fight to happen, either in Ireland or in Britain. But they get kind of, and this is very simplifying it a lot, but they get fed up with nothing happening. And so some of them decide that actually they need to take action. And there is then a big split in Chicago, particularly between those who want to actually run bombing campaigns themselves. And that's a group led by a very influential lawyer called Alexander Sullivan, whose wife is also a very influential journalist in Chicago at the time. So he wants there to be bombing campaigns, and he gets behind trying to blow up places in London, like, you know, the Houses of Parliament and London Bridge. They're not very successful because in every Irish secret society, there are spies. And so generally, the British government knows what's happening. But the whole purpose of what they're trying to do is really controversial. So some of those in Chicago are totally opposed to that because they think that that's not their purpose, that's not what they should be doing, and also that they're actually risking civilian lives. They're not happy with that. So you get this split then in Chicago, and that ultimately goes on to become a much bigger split. And it comes to a head in the 1880s when this guy, Alexander Sullivan, he's quite good friends with the first Catholic Archbishop of Chicago. And generally speaking, the church kind of is not massively in favor of this use of violence. But his mate is kind of like, yeah, you can kind of do what you like in Chicago. So Chicago becomes kind of the wing of the most virulently kind of pro-violence because they're not being put down by the church. But one of those opposed to Sullivan and his use of violence is a guy called Patrick Henry Cronin, and he's a medical doctor in Chicago, also a member of the same secret society, but he doesn't like this use of violence in this particular way. It's not that he's necessarily opposed to violence, but just how they're doing it. And he starts calling out Sullivan and, you know, says Sullivan is not only is he using violence, but he's also embezzled funds that were meant to go to Ireland and didn't go to Ireland, and creates kind of this big ruckus within the Irish American community in Chicago. Now, you know, this is not sort of something that everyone knows. This is within this own group. He then gets expelled from that group and there's a big kerfuffle. And then suddenly it all goes silent because he disappears. And he goes missing on the 4th of May, 1889. He goes missing. He's a medical doctor, so he gets called out to go to an incident in an ice house in Lakeview, which is way up north in Chicago. It's not even part of the city at the time. He gets called out there and he's never seen again. Now, they pass about 90 doctors. So he's not the closest doctor. So it's all like, why would they call to him? His friends call the police. The police say, look, you know, middle-aged, single man in Chicago. Should they go missing all the time? Maybe he was having an affair and he had to leave, you know, rapidly. So they sort of give a half-hearted look and kind of go, look, yeah, what's the point? No point in looking for this man. He's entitled to go anywhere he wants. And eventually, 2 weeks after he goes missing, a detective called Dan Coughlin calls a press conference and all the newspapers gather and he says, look, we've looked for him. We can't find him. The case is essentially closed. You know, off you go. Find other things to talk about.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll hear what happens to Cronin.
And the very next day, two public workers discover the body of a naked, beaten man in a sewer. And they pull out the body, and it's Cronin. The newspapers sort of run with this story. It becomes Cronin. And the police now have to obviously investigate a murder. And they start to arrest people. And the very first person they arrest and charge with the murder of Cronin is the detective Daniel Coughlin, who was charged with looking for him in the first place. And then it turns out that Daniel Coughlin, plus a number of other people who they arrest and charge with the murder, were part of the same group, the same faction of Clanmaegale that Alexander Sullivan was in charge of. And Alexander Sullivan was the person who'd fallen out with Patrick Henry Cronin. So the newspapers, it's not just Chicago newspapers, it's every English language newspaper. It's illustrations in things like Judge and Puck, all about the murder. It's the beginning of kind of what becomes known as yellow journalism and kind of tabloid journalism. It's sensational. So it's everywhere, absolutely everywhere. It's so much so that the dime museums in Chicago, they have waxworks of the dead man. They've got waxworks of the accused. They've the whole storyboard there. Cronin's funeral, when it happens towards the end of May, is the biggest funeral Chicago's seen since Abraham Lincoln's funeral cortege came through the city. About 40,000 people lined Michigan Avenue to see his body being brought to Holy Name Cathedral. And then another 20,000 went down to the train station where they put him on board a train to bring him up to Calvary Cemetery in Evanston. So the murder is huge, and it shines a light on a secret society. You know, no secret society wants its business, you know, across the pages of national and international newspapers. And then when the trial happens, that everything about the trial, like there's crowds, women go to the trial bringing smelling salts because it's so crowded to sort of resurrect themselves when they're squashed. And eventually, at the end of the trial, three men are found guilty and sentenced to life imprisonment. The public are not happy with this. They wanted the death penalty. Everyone thought that these men were guilty. One of the jurors held out and wouldn't vote for the death penalty. And he gets run out of Chicago. Like, he can't stay in Chicago because he gets so many threats against him. Alexander Sullivan doesn't stand trial because, like, you know, he didn't do it, but everyone believes that it was on his orders. So his career ends up going down the toilet. The police look like they're terribly corrupt, given, you know, that one of their own is jailed for murder. There was a jury bribing case as part of this. So the judiciary look like they're corrupt and in the pockets of the Irish. And that's the reason why the year after all of this happens, there is no St. Patrick's Day parade or no St. Patrick's Day picnic or no St. Patrick's Day anything, because the Irish reputation in Chicago is so tarnished by what had happened during the previous year.
This sinister chain of events impacted more than just the St. Patrick's Day parade that year in Chicago. Nationally, the tide of American support for the Irish cause started shifting.
There had been quite a lot of support in the United States at government level for kind of the Irish cause, because there were a lot of votes in that. Once Cronin is murdered, it's like, hang on, this is happening in our country. These are the Irish who are essentially taking their Irish fight, but they're doing it on American soil. And that's not good. And so you find that, like, where they had been able to raise quite a lot of money, that essentially all falls apart until kind of into the 20th century. So that happens in the kind of 1889. And it's not until really after 1916 that when there's an Easter Rising in Ireland that takes place in Dublin, primarily, that money comes back.
That is very interesting. And so I think you kind of touched on it, but could you expand upon, like, whatever implications either side had, and it's just like relevance to the culture of Chicago.
It definitely leaves a vacancy for others to come in. And I think that the Irish would have not seen themselves as the same as, say, the Italian mobs, because they felt they had a political kind of reason for doing what they were doing. So it wasn't so much about racketeering. A lot of people who joined Clan na Gael and these secret societies joined them partly because they saw it as a fraternal organization. Yes, in their heads, a free Ireland was a good thing. But actually, they were joining because their neighbor was a member, or it was a way to get a job or a way to get a house. But when the murder happened, they were like, oh, hang on, this was kind of where you went to the bar, talked with your mates. And yet we had this sort of idea that I'm a free Ireland, but we didn't want to be involved in having blood on our hands. So they all drop off, and quite a few of those go into kind of labour organisations instead, rather than Irish Republican movement. In the police force, there is kind of this huge sweep out of kind of corrupt police officers, which does make a difference. In the judiciary, there are all sorts of problems about jury bribing. So there's another big sweep through the judiciary about, you know, how jurors are being tapped for bribes. There's a spotlight turned on that. And then the newspapers, they go from strength to strength because they're like, these convictions would never have happened without us pushing. And they're absolutely going, but we're great. So, you know, there are all sorts of people having to kind of look at themselves and go, okay. And for a lot of Irish Americans who would have been totally to their own community, they begin to kind of be a bit more, I guess, American.
So if this event did indeed turn Irish Chicagoans towards labor organizations, their influence throughout history is still seen today. Since 1962, members of the Chicago Journeyman Plumbers Local Union 130 UA have been in charge of dyeing a portion of the Chicago River green with a dye that was originally used to find underwater leaks in sewage pipes. And of course, throughout the city during this month of March, you can find Irish dance shows and live bands that celebrate Irish heritage. Thanks for listening to this episode of Looped in Chicago. This episode was hosted by me, Jim Hankey, and was written and produced by Ariel Ravenay. Craig Schwalb is our station's news director, and Myron Kaplan is our managing producer of national news podcasts. To see St. Paddy's Day events around Chicago, check out our station's socials on Instagram at WBBM News Radio or on TikTok at WBBM News Radio 105.9. We'll keep you looped in back here in a few weeks. See you then.